So as I was saying, let's start from scratch. Welcome to Geometry and Topology for Physicists. This course is going to be taught by both myself and Kevin Costello, who's going to take over after the first four lectures. So I'm going to go quickly over the course outline. So the instructors are going to be Kevin and myself, as I said. The teaching assistant is going to be Yao Zhou. And you're going to meet the teaching assistant at tutorials. My office, well, most of you know my office. I know there's at least one person who doesn't know where it is, and it's 264. It's the first office on the left when you get into the corridor right there. You should be able to find me in my office the day that we have lectures or tutorials. If I'm not in my office, you can just send me an email, and then we can either schedule something or we can have a meeting over Zoom. OK, so this course is going to cover topics in both topology and differential geometry for applications in physics. And the topics we're going to do are these. We're going to start with my part of the course. It's going to be a review of topology. Then we're going to talk about topological and smooth manifolds. And we're going to talk about tensor bundles in general. This includes the tangent bundle, the cotangent bundle, and tensor bundles in general. Then Kevin is going to take over and is going to first talk about differential forms, cohomology, and integration of manifolds. Then it's going to talk about Riemann surfaces. And then at the end, there's going to be something about principal bundles and introduction to gauge theory with a little bit of a very brief review of Lie algebras and Lie groups, just with the things that are needed for principal bundles and gauge theory. OK, so we're going to have lectures. You're here, so you know when the lectures are. You can read the rest yourself. Nothing is necessary for today. So let's get right over to the next thing. Lecture notes, you can find them for my part of the course on the PSI portal. So here are the lecture notes for today. I'm still finishing the ones for the next lecture, so I'll post them a little bit before the lecture at the very least. Kevin is not going to have lecture notes for his part of the course. So you're going to find these lecture notes here. If we have any additional material, we'll put it in the outline, as well as the links to the recordings once they're ready. OK, any questions about the outline before we get started? OK, then let's get to it. OK, so the plan for today is to briefly introduce topology. I'm not assuming that any of you know anything about topology. I'm just going to teach you what we need, but we're not going to go deep into it. And then we'll just go straight to manifolds, and we're going to see examples of manifolds. Is the writing big enough for everyone to read? OK, so let's start with topology. First of all, let's motivate topology. Topology is just a framework that we use to generalize the notion of limits and continuity that we have from analysis on R, Rn, and in general Euclidean spaces or vector spaces. And we want to generalize this to any kind of weird space that you might think of. So for example, if we're working with R, limits in R are usually defined like this. I'm using limits of sequences just because it simplifies things a little bit. So suppose you have a sequence, and here An is a sequence. So we have the sequence of An and in the natural numbers. It's just a sequence, infinite, but countable of numbers. So we say that the limit as n goes to infinity of the sequence is some number L if, you've probably seen these things many times, but for every epsilon greater than 0, there is some capital N, which is a certain threshold, after which, if you keep going with the sequence, all of the elements of the sequence are going to be in this open interval, which is some interval of length 2 epsilon around L. So this is the usual definition. It works well with R, but you cannot generalize it in general because there are no open intervals for a general set. So what we want to do is, instead of writing this, we want to replace this part, the for all epsilon greater than 0, and this part where we have the open interval, we want to replace them with something else. We want the notion of open sets that generalizes the idea of open intervals in R. And eventually, what we want to be able to write is the limit as n goes to infinity of a sequence an equals L, but this time L is in some weird set X. It doesn't have to be R anymore. It can be a set of functions. It can be a set of lines. It can be a set of sets. It can be any weird thing you might want to think of. And now, instead of for all epsilon greater than 0, we're going to say just for all open sets. So for all open sets to be defined, we usually call them U, containing L. So not just any open set, they need to contain L, just like this interval here contains L. And then we still have there is n greater than 0, such that after this threshold, we have an belongs to U. So these open sets are just a way to define what arbitrarily close means. Remember, this thing just means that we can get arbitrarily close to L when n is big enough. Now, this relies on the notion of distance. That's how we say arbitrarily close. This epsilon is a very small distance. We say we can get as close as we want to it. If we don't have a notion of distance, we need something else. And that's what open sets do. So all we need to do is define open sets. Any questions so far? Is the motivation clear enough? OK, so now we're ready to define what a topological space is. So a topological space is a set that we're going to call X. And together with the set, we're going to attach some more structure, a collection of sets, really a collection of subsets of X. We're going to call it tau with the subscript X, just so we remember that it's attached to X. The sets in this collection are what we call the open sets. And the open sets need to satisfy these three properties. The first one is that the empty set and X itself are open. And that's something that also happens with R. We're trying to generalize R. In R, we say that the empty set is open, just by convention, really. And R itself, we think of it as being open, an open interval, just infinite. Then the second property is that if you have two open sets, so two elements of tau, if you intersect them, they should still be in tau, so they should still be open. So this property, we call it finite intersection. Telling us that any intersection of finitely many open sets is finite. And this is something that also happens with open intervals. You take the intersection of two open intervals, it's still something that's open. It can either be empty or still an open interval. And finally, if we take any collection of open sets, so we have this ui with some index I in capital I. It can be any kind of indices. It can be countable. It can be uncountable. It doesn't matter. Then you take the union of all of these things, which are possibly infinitely many, possibly uncountably many. This new set that comes up should still be open. So arbitrary unions to still be open. And this, again, is something that we want to generalize from the topology on R. And one last thing on notation, this tau, we're going to, this set of open sets, we actually call it a topology on X. Of course, there's going to be more than one possible topology, but this is one that gives the topological space structure to X. So we're not going to really go very deep into this, and we're actually never going to really use it. But we need to know what the topological space is, so I had to introduce this notion. Now, if you're wondering why finite intersections, why we allow arbitrary unions, there's a good reason. If you, for example, consider in Rn, or just R, if we have all of these kind of open sets, minus epsilon to epsilon, so let's take this collection, I'm going to call it T because it's a collection. So we have a set of all these things. So we're taking all of the possible open intervals centered at the origin. If you go and take the intersection of everything in C, which I think we can denote by this, so this is the set that contains the intersection of all of these intervals, well, this is going to actually end up having one element in it, and it's zero. Because zero belongs to every one of those open intervals. And when you take the intersection of all of them, the only thing left is zero. But then this is not something we would say is open in R. So if we are trying to generalize this notion, we cannot allow for infinite intersection. Any questions so far? Okay, let's see some examples. What we call the standard topology on R, which is what we used to define the limit at the very beginning, is just taking as open sets all the open intervals and all of the possible unions. So we're going to consider open intervals of the form AB with A less or equal than B. I'm using less or equal because this includes the case in which you have the open interval AA, but that doesn't have anything in it, so that's the empty set. So the empty set is still in here, and then you can, if you really want to, check that all of those properties actually hold. Same idea applies to Rn, just a bit more tricky if you want to actually prove it. In Rn, all the open sets for the standard topology are the all the possible unions, finite, infinite, uncountable, and so on, of the open balls, there are the sets defined like this. You have your center point that we call x, the radius that we call r, and then we're going to take all of the points y that are at most, in fact, strictly less than r distance from x. So this is going to be in 2D. If this is our point x, then we take all of the points in the disk, but not the outside, because that's exactly distance r. So all of these are open sets. And if you take any union of them, this is also going to be an open set. And again, I'm going to allow r to be 0, so that there's nothing in this set, and the empty set is open. And finally, the last example of topology we are interested in is what we call the induced topology. If x is a topological space, and you have any subset S of X, then we can also make the subset S into a topological space. And we do this by inducing the topology from the bigger space, which already has it, down to the subspace. So the topology on S is given by this. It has a S subscript because tau is attached to S now. We take all of the open sets that are open for X, and then we take the intersection with the set S itself. And it's not difficult to show that this satisfies all of the properties of topology if tau is a topology for x. And the reason why we do this is that it's consistent with the topology on R. If you have any subset of R or subset of Rn, and then you use this induced topology, everything makes sense. Calculus works, and geometry does as well. Any questions? So far, this is all I'm going to say about topology. So if there are any questions, this is the time. OK, then we can move on to the actual. Sorry, forgot something. There is something more to say about topology. And it is, why do we care about topology? My bad. Why do we care about topology? The motivation I've given so far is not actually why we care about topology. It is true that you can use topology to define limits, to define continuity, but that's not what we want. It turns out that topology encodes geometrical information. Which is really why we care about topology, at least in this course. There are other reasons to care about topology as well. Yes?
I know the definition of topology that you introduced before, and I know that we also can relate to geometric information, but I cannot connect the two of them. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, I can try to explain that. So first of all, the question was, how exactly do you connect this geometrical information to the definition that we had above? But let me first tell you exactly what kind of thing topology encodes, and then I can try to give a brief introduction to what happens here. So for example, topology has information about whether a space is disjoint. We call this connectedness. If X is made of these joint pieces. Other thing you can tell us about is presence of holes. So for example, for a torus, there's going to be a hole in the middle, and topology encodes this information about the hole in the middle. It can tell us about whether something is compact. This is a generalization of closed and bounded. From Rn. This is very important because compactness is kind of a way of saying if something is infinitely big or not. And this is all encoded in the topology as well. Another thing you can tell us about is whether there is a boundary for a particular set. And many other things. You can use it to describe knots, and then it tells you how the knots work, how many crossings you have, and so on. So we're not really go deep into these things at all. If we need any of these notions later in the course, they're going to be introduced when they're needed, because there's way too much to talk about this, and we really don't have time. But to give an idea of, for example, how do you do this, connectedness, for example, you can use these open sets to decide if something is connected by checking whether you can, if you have two regions, if you can completely cover one of them with open sets and another one with open sets, and these open sets don't overlap at all, then you can say that this is a disjoint set. So you use the open sets to get this information. For holes and other things, it's a bit more convoluted. You cannot just easily just get it from here. And in fact, usually, you don't go and check the topology itself. That's not the easy way of doing this. But you're going to actually talk about this when you see cohomology. So cohomology is a way of, for example, looking at the presence of holes. And all the information is topological because it all derives from the topology, but you don't have to actually go and check it by hand. But I want to give some better intuition of why we need topology. So for example, suppose that I give you a sphere. Now, a sphere is a set of points, right? So it's just a subset of, and actually maybe something more simpler than a sphere. Let me just create a new page so I can write more stuff. So suppose that we have the circle. So S1 is just going to be the unit circle, which is just this nice circular thing. Now, you may think, well, S1 has something interesting. Geometrically speaking, it has a hole in the middle. So if you want to know why we need topology for the information, think of it this way. S1 has the same cardinality as R. In the sense that it has the same number of points. This is an algebra notion. I don't know if everyone is fully familiar with cardinality, but essentially cardinality means that there is a way to map S1 into R. Even if you don't know what it is, there is a way to do it. Now, because the cardinality is the same, it means that you can always consider some function f from S1 to R, which is invertible. And we don't even need to come up with what it is. We know that this thing is true. Now, if this is true, then this means that we can just relabel stuff inside S1, and then it looks like R. That's what these functions do. These functions just change names to all the points. If you just relabel everything, what looked like a circle before now looks like a line. This means that any information about the hole in the middle is not in the set itself. The set itself doesn't know about geometry. The set itself only knows about, I have this many points in me, and that's it. And I'm calling them this, but you can always change names, and then a set becomes something different. Therefore, you need additional structure to talk about this. Now, this is often confusing, because when you think of a circle, you're thinking of a circle as a subset over R2. When you think of R2, you're thinking of R2 as a topological space with a standard topology. Even if you don't think about it, you are assuming there's that in the background. So when you think of a circle and say, well, the circle obviously has a hole, I'm looking at it, it has a hole in the middle, that's because you are looking at it with the eyes of someone who knows it has the induced topology that it gets from R2, which has the standard topology. So you are doing topology, even if you don't know about it. But if you try to forget about that, then all the bets are off, anything can happen. And to make things even more interesting, R has the same topology, it has the same cardinality as R2. So as it turns out, that plane where the circle is inside can actually be a line if you want to, if you just move things around. And then the circle is not living in R2 anymore. So this whole thing is, well, to show you that there's something interesting happening, but also why we actually need some extra structure. We just take it for granted most of the time, but we do need this structure because that's where the geometry is. Just that we usually have it in the background and we don't think about it. And of course, if you use different topologies, you're going to have different geometries and things can get very weird. But this brings me to the next point of what I want to talk today is that we do not want to do weird things. So this nice definition that we have above a topological space, we don't actually care because we don't want a generic topological space. Those are way too weird for what we are interested in. Instead, we want to work with manifolds. I inserted the page in the wrong place. So we want to work with manifolds. The topological spaces we're interested in are the ones that look like Rn, at least locally. So they are not any weird spaces. Their topology is kind of like the topology of Rn. It just maybe not everywhere. Now, what does look like Rn locally means? We're interested in things in sets such that if you look at them close enough, you can essentially not distinguish them from Rn itself. The classical example of this is you have a sphere, a familiar one, say Earth, if we think of it as a sphere. But if you want to look at a particular place, say a city, then you can just look at a chart, which is just a square thing where everything looks like it has coordinates x and y. And for every possible city on Earth, you can think of it that way. But if you look at the big picture of the sphere, you cannot actually describe the whole thing with Cartesian coordinates x, y. That doesn't work. So the sphere looks like R2 in every little chart around a town or a city, but not globally if you look at it from outside. That's what we're trying to generalize with the notion of manifold. So to do this, we need the notion of what a chart is, which is the equivalent of looking at a little city or a big city and then just mapping it on a 2D square thing where you have x, y coordinates. So formally, if we have a set M, a chart is a way to assign coordinates in Rn, so n coordinates, to a particular subset U of M. It doesn't have to be the whole thing, just a subset. So if you want to be more specific, a chair is going to be mathematically a pair containing two things. One of them is the set U, and the other one is a function phi. So U is a subset of M. Phi is a function that goes from U to Rn, and we want it to be injective. If you're not familiar with the term, injective is the same as one-to-one, which means that every point in U is going to be mapped to only one point in Rn. Sorry, that's the definition of function. Any point in Rn, or at least in the image of this function, can only come from one point in U. No two points are mapped to the same thing, essentially. We want this because we want this to be invertible. If something is injective, then if you restrict the codomain to exactly all the points that you can reach, you can actually invert this. And the other thing that we need is that the image is an open subset of Rn. So this may look a bit different than the idea of, well, you have a chart of Earth, and you just map it down, because usually you do see there's a boundary. It's not going to be an open subset of Rn. But that's not going to work for us. We do need the sets to be open. So this is what the chart does. We have, for example, the sphere. And then we take a little region of it. This is the sphere S2. This is the plane R2. And then we're going to map this region here to some open region in R2. So that's the plan of what the chart does. And again, it generalizes this idea of giving coordinates to a little region of Earth by mapping it to a local chart. And that's why we call it chart. Everything clear about charts? OK, now that we have charts, we can consider atlases, which are just collections of charts. Yes?
I'm still thinking about the last definition. Is that should be the same as it's bicontinuous, right? Is that obvious from that definition?
Right, so you're asking in this definition whether this function phi should be continuous and also the inverse continuous.
Is the injectivity constraint the same as the pre-image?
Yes, so this is a great question. If you already know about these things, this definition may not look exactly like the ones you're used to. There are many ways of defining these things. I'm choosing to not give a topology to the set M yet. So this means it doesn't actually make any sense to ask whether this function is continuous or not, because we don't know. We cannot know, because we don't know the topology on M. So for our purposes, a chart is just a way of mapping a set U into Rn. The only requirement is that the image of it is going to be open in Rn. That's the only thing we want. But we're not asking that U is open, because we don't know what that means. We're not asking that phi is continuous, because we don't know what that means. OK, so an atlas is simply a collection of charts. It can be, we have, again, this I in capital I. So we're going to have a collection of charts. We're going to call them ui phi I. This index can be a continuous index, a discrete index, can be finitely many. It doesn't matter. We have a collection of charts. They are all going to Rn. And that's why we say that the atlas is n-dimensional. There are no such things as atlases with different dimensions in them. You want to map everything to the same thing. If you look at the sphere, at the Earth, or a sphere in general, you're going to map everything locally to R2. You cannot have parts of it that you map to R3. That's not what we're trying to achieve here. The things we have to satisfy for a collection of charts to be an atlas is, first of all, that if you take the union of all the possible regions ui, you should get the whole set M. So the charts cover M. That's what an atlas is. It's a collection of charts that describes the whole place. So if you look at all the possible little maps of all the possible regions on Earth, and then you piece all of them together, you want to be able to cover the whole thing. The next thing we require is that if you look at the intersection of any of these two regions, UI and UJ, and then you look at the image phi I of this set, this is still going to be open. So not only phi I of UI is open, because we knew that from the definition of chart, if you take this intersection, this is also going to be open. This definition may look a bit weird, but it's needed in order to then actually give a topology to the set. And finally, we're going to look at these maps. These maps are called transition. Maps. So you take the inverse of phi j and then compose it with phi I. These maps essentially, they're called transition maps because they tell you how to go from one chart to the other. And the idea is that if you have, your set M, which I'm writing like this just to show that it's not the usual flat Rn, so we just do some wiggly things. And then you have your UI and UJ. If UI and UJ intersect, so there's a region here that's not empty, there's the intersection, then on this region, we have two maps. We have phi I, but also phi j. We can use two different charts. And because we are piecing together all of this information from the various regions, we want to make sure that we are able to actually piece it together nicely. So on this region, on UI intersection UJ, both phi I and phi j work. So we're going to look at the transition maps, phi I composed by j to the minus 1. And this thing is actually going to be a map that goes from some subset, let me call it W, of Rn to Rn. Because phi inverse now goes from Rn back into our set M. But then phi maps that back into Rn. So these transition functions are actually chosen so that they are not functions between this weird set and Rn, but they are functions between Rn and Rn. The reason why this is good is that we know how to do stuff for functions between Rn and Rn. We know when they're continuous, we know when they're differentiables, we can take derivatives, we can take limits. Everything is nice and well-defined. Is this last thing that I described clear, or do you need a graphical representation of what's happening? It may be better to have a graphical representation just in case. We're going to have two different versions of Rn. You have a map here, which is phi I, that's going to map UI to some subset here. And then we're going to map this one using phi j, and this is going to map here. They are normally different things, but because this is invertible, we can also go back using phi j to the minus 1. So what we're really doing here is checking how can we go from the points in here, which are coordinates. We're assigning points in Rn to our points on the set, which means we're assigning coordinates. So for a sphere, we're assigning x, y Cartesian coordinates to a certain town. But then we look at a different chart, which has a different set of coordinates, x prime, y prime. And we want to know if I tell you the coordinates on this region. So if the coordinates here are x, y, and the coordinates here are x prime, y prime, the question of the transition maps is, if I tell you that in my chart, these are the coordinates, in your chart, what are the coordinates? And the function pi I composed by j to the minus 1 is exactly the function. You feed it x, y, it spits out x prime, y prime. So the requirement that we need for an atlas to be an atlas is that these functions are not just any random functions, they are continuous. That's all that we require. Everything clear up to this point? Okay. Additionally, that's the definition of a normal atlas, but if the atlas has transition maps that not only are continuous, but they're of class C infinity, which is a fancy way of saying we can take derivatives on them as many times as we want, then we're going to say that the atlas is a smooth atlas. And generally, smooth is the word that we're going to use whenever something has this C infinity property that we can take infinitely many derivatives. Okay, so we're almost there. And then we can see a bunch of examples. At this point, we have all the ingredients to define a manifold. A manifold, topological is in parentheses because all the manifolds are going to be topological, so we're not really going to keep saying topological every time, is some set M together with an n-dimensional atlas that we're going to call A with the subscript M, just to remember that it goes with M. So that's all that is. We have this set M, and then we have an atlas, which is a collection of charts, which is a way to map all of the points, to give coordinates to all of the points on this set. Different points, well, the different regions are going to have different charts, and we have a way to glue all these charts together in a nice way. At the very least, continuous, and if we want it to be smooth, then in a smooth C infinity way. We're going to say that the dimension of the manifold, which just denote by dimension dim m, is n. And the n is the same here as the dimension of the atlas. So if we are mapping everything to R2, it's a two-dimensional manifold. If we're mapping to R1, it's a one-dimensional manifold, and so on. And just as for the atlas, if the atlas is smooth, so all of the transition functions are C infinity, then the whole manifold we call it smooth. Technically, there are many in-between things. We have continuous things. We have C infinity things. We are skipping all of the differentiable ones twice, three times, and so on. We don't really care about that. Generally, we're always going to work with smooth manifold. The reason why topological manifolds are interesting is that they are just topological spaces. Now, you may be wondering how exactly are they topological spaces, because as I mentioned before, and as Matthew was pointing out, I never talked about any topology on these spaces. Topology on M is the question. So as it turns out, the charts, or really the atlas, induces a topology on M. So all that you need to do is essentially ask, that the atlases are continuous, although we didn't really define what continuous functions is. Now, because this is not actually important for us, I'm not going to go into this. If you're interested in exactly what the topology is, it's in the I brought it in the notes. I didn't prove it, but you can prove it if you're really interested in. And if it's not clear, you can just ask me. But I don't think it will actually add much to what we're doing. And I'd rather just have 20 minutes of examples rather than spend time on this, unless everyone really wants to know what the topology is, which I don't think is very important. So this is your chance to let me know if you're interested in knowing. Yes?
Can you give an example of a manifold which is not smooth. I want just to imagine this. Type.
Can you repeat? A manifold which is not?
Not smooth.
A manifold which is not smooth?
C1 differentiable.
That's a good question. So,
C1 manifold can be made into C infinity. So if you want a non-smooth manifold, it has to be like not continuous anymore. So it has to be very weird.
Yeah, so it's very difficult to imagine these things.
If it's C2, it can be made C infinity.
This is not an easy question. Because something that, I mean, I didn't point out, but it should be kind of obvious. If you have a smooth manifold, the smooth manifold is also a manifold. It's, if the functions are C infinity, they're also continuous. The reverse is obviously not true. So there's a question which is not easy to formulate properly, which is, if you have a topological manifold, can you make it into a differentiable manifold? And that's not an easy question to formulate, because you are non, you don't even necessarily know what these parts are. But all these cases are really not things that we're interested in. So we're not going to consider any of these weird things in this course. I cannot think off the top of my head of a case that does something like this, because as I said before, you can always change things into making them look like something that you know. So for example, a square is something that usually people think of not being, or a cube, an open cube, for example. So you have a cube, but without the boundary. That's something you can make into topological space, and you may think, well, because it has the corners, then it's not smooth. But you can easily take that, change it into a sphere, and then the sphere you can make smooth. So if you use this map to kind of borrow the structure from the sphere, you could make that into a smooth manifold as well. So it's not an easy question to even formulate, and not one that people are usually interested in. One thing that is interesting, but we're not going to cover because it's way too advanced for what we need to do, is that you can have manifolds which are the same as topological manifolds, but they have different smooth structures, which means you can make them into smooth manifold in more than one way. And that's a very weird thing that we're not going to go into, but it's interesting. And if you're interested about it, you can just ask me. Any other questions before I move on to examples? Yes?
I understand this point. You're saying that because the transition maps are maps between Rn and Rn, and that has a topology attached to it already, you can induce the topology on the manifold based on the continuity of the transition map.
Not the transition map. So you're asking exactly how you induce this topology. Again, I don't want to spend too much time on this, so you can ask me later, unless really everything is interested. But again, it's more of a curiosity. I mean, I can tell you, and then it's a formula written on paper. You're never going to use it again. So I don't think it's beneficial to try to do it now. But if you're interested, just ask me at the end of the lecture. OK, so I'd like to go on to examples. Yes?
I have a comment. So
Yes, indeed, there are examples of things that are topological manifolds that admit no structure which is compatible with the topology. But again, we don't have time to go into all the details. So all of these weird things, if you're interested, just come and ask me. We can talk about all this weird stuff. But I would like to talk about the simple stuff, because we don't have 20 minutes anymore. So let's go on to the nice examples, or at least the things that we're going to use in this course. So the simplest trivial examples of all are these two. Rn is a manifold, because guess what? Rn looks like Rn. So that one is easy. So we can just check it. The next easiest thing is, if you have an open subset of Rn, so U is an open subset of Rn, then this is also a manifold. So both of these cases actually use the same idea. And we use only one chart. Which is this function pi, which is just the identity map restricted to you. So you're just going to take whatever set you have, map it to Rn. The output is obviously open because you start with an open set. There's only one chart. There are no transition functions. And that's it. You're done. It's a manifold. So this is the easiest thing, but it should surprise no one because they are obviously looking like Rn. Now on to more interesting things. The unit sphere can be made into a manifold. So the unit sphere is a set of all the points in R3 such that x squared plus y squared plus z squared equals 1. So we're just taking only the sphere, not the inside of it. Now, any ideas on, first of all, what the dimension of this sphere is? I mean, I kind of told you already before, but just a check if you were listening. Anyone? What is the dimension of this manifold going to be, according to you? OK, so 2. That's a very good guess, but remembering what I told you at the beginning, this is actually not obvious at all. I can make this into whatever manifold I want. I can make into a dimension 1 manifold, 2, 3, 4. I can do whatever I want because this, as a set, is the same as Rn for whatever n I want. Remember that they have the same cardinality. I can do whatever I want. So it's really important to remember that what we're trying to do right now is to have something that has a nice topology that matches the one it will get from R3. This is a sphere. It's embedded in R3. If you take the topology in R3 and you induce it on the sphere, we want to get that. So I could come up with a lot of different ways to make it into a manifold, but they will all be wrong in the sense that they're not really getting what we want. OK, so charts. How many charts do you think we need for the sphere? 2? 1 is not going to cut it, because there's no way we're going to be able to map everything in one way. So we need at the very least 2. Any ideas of exactly what kind of charts to use? There's a lot of different ways.
Slice and project.
What do you say?
Projecting.
Projecting, yes. So you can do projections, which is what we're going to do now. So we're going to look at stereographic projections. Which they're probably the easiest way of doing this, but there are other ways. So for example, you could use polar spherical coordinates. You just fix R to be 1, and then you have 2 variables, theta and phi. The only problem with that is that it doesn't cover the whole thing, but also you have some points at which you're going to have non-differentiability, so you have to cut them out, then you have to rotate this chart and do it again. It's a bit more work, so we're not going to look at that, but you can also do that. Or lots of different ways. OK, so stereographic projections. Are a way of projecting the sphere down to the plane. The charts are going to have 2 different regions. So we're going to call them u plus minus, pi plus minus. U plus is going to be the one where we remove the point at the very top. So we're going to remove the north pole from the sphere. And all of the other points, we're going to be able to project down. U minus is the reverse idea. We're looking at things from upside down. We're going to remove the south pole, and then we project everything down to the plane. The actual map looks like this. So phi plus minus is going to take x, y, z, and it's going to send it, depending on whether we remove the top or the bottom, to x over 1 minus z for the removing the top, or plus z if you remove the south pole, and similarly for y. Now, let me show you exactly what this looks like, because it's probably not obvious if you've not seen this before. You can find what I'm about to show you in the lecture notes. There are going to be links to open these things, so you can reopen them and play with them if you're interested in. So the stereographic projection do this. We have a sphere, and here I'm looking at the North Pole. So I'm removing the North Pole, and this is the projection from the North Pole. And then you can use this switch to go to the other one. So if I have a point P that I move around, the projection works like this. We're going to consider the line that passes through the point North Pole and the point P. Then we intersect this line with the XY plane. Whatever coordinates we hit, those are the coordinates of the point. That's all we're doing. And you can move this thing around and easily convince yourself that every point is going to be mapped to only one thing. And notice that if you go below, you are still going to be able to project things. It's just that now the intersection happens before you reach the point, but you're still able to intersect everything. The only thing that you cannot map is exactly the top point, because the line passing between a point and itself is undefined. There's too many of them, so you cannot actually say. And from the bottom, you have the same idea, just the picture is completely reversed. So these are the charts. Of course, we need to actually show that these charts behave nicely. You need to look at the inverses, look at the transition maps, and check whether everything is nice. We're not going to do this right now, but you're going to be able to do that during tutorials, so you can actually check all these things yourself. One other thing I wanted to show you about stereographic projections, just because it's cool. Is exactly how the inverse stereographic projection works. So you can look at these two just to convince yourself that this makes sense. And this may be helpful when you're doing this tutorial. What I'm doing here is taking this grid on the XY plane and then mapping it back onto the sphere. So the inverse function is just changing our coordinates back into the sphere. And you can see that what used to be a nice flat grid equally spaced, and now it's going to instead be sent to this thing where all the spacing is different. And by changing the sliders, you can see where each line is going to be sent by looking at the slice here. So all of these things are actually going to be kind of curves on the sphere, and I just think this looks kind of cool. But it's not really important. Just I wanted to show you this. OK, so on to the next example. And again, we're not showing this, and we're not really going to show it because it's not that important. But the topology that you induce on the sphere is the right one. It's the same one that you will get by looking at it as a subset of Rn. So it has the topology that we like. It's not some weird thing that we call sphere, but it's something else. It is actually a sphere. Okay, the next example is more interesting because it's weirder. It's not something that we can just obtain by looking at set as a subset of another set. Not easily, at least. And what we're going to look at is the projective plane. The projective plane is a set of all the lines passing through the origin in R3. At least it's one way of thinking about it. So it's a set of lines, not a set of points anymore. Another way of writing it out, which is a bit easier for what we're interested in, is to think of it in this way. It's a set of equivalence classes. It's a set of all the equivalence classes, and I don't know if you're familiar with the notation, but you usually put them in square brackets, of points. And the points are going to be in R3, but without the origin. And the equivalence relation is two points are equivalent if they are one the scalar multiple of the other. So if there is a lambda non-zero, such that x prime is the same as lambda x. And this is the same idea as thinking of all the lines, because all the lines that we are interested in are all just directions in Rn. To define a line, you just need to give me a vector, which is non-zero. And that's going to give me the whole line by looking at all the vectors, which are a scalar multiple of that one. Or if you want, if you think of it of a line as the span of a vector, vectors which are scalar multiples of each other have the same span. So hopefully that convinces you that this makes somewhat sense. to make this into a manifold, we're going to use three charts. The first chart is going to have as UI all of the points x1, x2, x3, all of the equivalence classes of these points, but where the first one is non-zero. Then the second one is going to have all of them, but the second one is non-zero, and so on. And then the charts themselves are going to look like this. Pi1 is going to take the equivalence class of x1, x2, x3, and it's going to map it to this. We're going to take 2 over x1. Maybe it's better to call them x, y, z. So we're going to assign two coordinates. So the plan is to make this into a two manifold. So this is going to be in R2. Now, the reason why we can do this is that the region U1, so this is just going from U1. The region U1 has all the equivalence classes where the first component, x1, is non-zero. So we can divide by it because it's non-zero. Everything is fine. And of course, whenever you have something that involves equivalence classes, you need to make sure that functions are well-defined, which means they don't depend on the representative that we're choosing. And in this case, everything works because you are dividing y by x, z by x. So even if you rescale everything by lambda, you get the same answer. So it doesn't matter which one you choose. If you choose x, y, z, or 2x, 2y, 2z, you get the same answer. So everything is fine. And then phi2 is going to be exactly the same thing. But because now y is different than 0, we're going to do x over y, z over y. And similarly, for the last one, we're going to divide by z. Again, we didn't check everything. These are the charts, but you need to check that they cover the whole thing. You need to check that they have all the transition functions working nicely. They map the intersections to open sets. So all of these things need to be checked, and you can do them during the tutorial. Or you can just trust me for now and believe that this is actually going to work. Now, this is a very interesting two-manifold because, unlike the things that we've seen before, this cannot be embedded into R3. By which I mean, you cannot take this set, map it to something that it's a subset of R3, and then induce the topology on the set and match it to this one. There is no subset of R3 that has the same topology as the projective plane, in other words. So this is a weird kind of manifold. And so it's a bit more interesting than, for example, the sphere, because the sphere, you just take it, put it into R3, or reverse, just take it from R3 and make it into a manifold. Of course, that doesn't mean that you can never embed it. There's a theorem that says that you can embed any manifold in R2n, where n is the dimension of the manifold. So you could embed this into R4, but then you cannot visualize it. Well, at least I cannot. I'm pretty sure you also cannot. Okay, so we don't really have time to see other examples. So are there any questions about any of these examples or things from before? There are two more examples, I think, in the lecture notes, so you can also look there. I'll probably just quickly go over at least one of them next lecture. Naturally, there is one thing that I just want to point out. The definition that I've given of manifold is not exactly the one that people generally use. It's missing a couple of important things. It doesn't matter for our purposes, so you can just use that in this course. If you're interested, just look at the very end of the lecture notes for today. There's an optional section. It's very brief, but it explains what's happening. And as usual, if you want more information, you can just ask me. Okay, so any questions? Yes?
What is your intuition for why the embedding into R3 doesn't work?
Why the embedding into R3 of this particular manifold doesn't work? The projective plane? I don't know if I have an intuitive way.
There's a very nice picture that you can draw. The projective plane, you can see it as basically a disk where you map the boundary of the disk in kind of like, how do you say this, like antipodal ways. So if you try to do that construction within R3, like you take a disk and you try to glue the boundary in antipodal points, you end up seeing that you have to twist it in a way that you physically can't. That's why you have to go to R4.
Starting off with the disk.
I mean, the manifold itself is two-dimensional. So it's literally the disk, and you're gluing the boundary. But if you try, it's like what happens with the Mobius band. The Mobius band is a one-dimensional manifold. You cannot embed it in two dimensions. You need three in order to make this twist. With a projective plane, it's a somewhat similar construction. At least that's a way that I...
But it's not the same as the Mobius band, though.
Yeah.
The Mobius band, you can embed it into R3. And it's a two-dimensional manifold.
True.
I cannot think of an intuitive way of why it shouldn't work that makes it clear.
I guess because what you're saying is I make like a cigar out of it in some sense. Like,
no, it's like antipodal identification, so you have to...
There's like one point that you end up with that you can't.
Yeah.
I think what Hamel is trying to say is that if you try to embed it, you're always going to, in a way that it fits into the topology that you're trying to do, you're always going to end up with self-intersections.
Yeah, and actually there's a nice embedding of the projective plane in R3, except for one line that you have to cut through. Because you can always embed things if you cut, and you can embed the projective plane if you cut once. And it's like a very, it's kind of a weird construction.
Okay, well, the lecture is over. If you have any additional questions, you can still come and ask now. But otherwise, I'll see you on Thursday.